only new work, it's very incomplete work. And part of the reason that I'm talking about it here is in the hope that some of you tell me what I'm missing or what I've gotten wrong, or at least give me some ideas of where to go with this next. So the basic idea that I'm, the basic starting point of this work is fairly simple and I think is becoming more widely appreciated these days. And this has to do with the behavior of theories with gauge symmetries on manifolds with boundaries. So to start with, most of the physical theories that we know are written in terms of an action whose variation gives classical field equations and whose path integral gives quantum amplitudes. If you have an action on a manifold with boundary, typically you are forced to add an additional boundary piece to the action. In the classical theory, this boundary piece is required just by saying that you want the action to have genuine extrema. When you vary an action, you typically have integrations by parts, which you don't care about if the manifold doesn't have a boundary. But if it does, you get boundary pieces that you have to make sure get canceled off. In the quantum mechanical formulation, it is probably true, it's known to be true in simple cases, that the correct boundary term is needed in order to sew together amplitudes. That is, if you have a path integral going from here to here and a path integral going from here to here, quantum mechanically you should be able to combine those by summing over a complete set of intermediate states. In other words, by integrating over appropriate fields at the boundaries. But this only works if you have the right boundary term to your action. Now, for an action without gauge symmetries, this is all fairly straightforward and non-controversial. If you have gauge symmetries, though, things change a little bit, because typically, unless you are very careful and very lucky, the boundary term in your action is not going to be invariant under the full gauge symmetry. In other words, that means that some configurations that used to be considered physically equivalent are now inequivalent because the action, including the boundary term, is no longer fully invariant. Another way of saying this, which is essentially equivalent, is that if you want to add the boundary term and preserve gauge invariance, it may be necessary to add additional degrees of freedom that restore the gauge invariance at the boundary. So I'm going to talk about how this works for 2+1 dimensional gravity. First, very briefly summarizing some old results for the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case, and then mostly talking about new work in progress for the asymptotically flat case. The reason that this is that 2+1 dimensional gravity is an interesting playground for this is that in pure gravity in three space-time dimensions, there are no propagating degrees of freedom. So most of what's interesting happens just with this boundary term. But presumably, at least I hope, these methods can be fairly straightforwardly generalized to 3+1 dimensions, where they will probably relate to recent work by people like Andy Strominger on boundary symmetries and super translations and super rotations. I'll say a little bit more about that at the end. Okay, so 2+1 dimensional gravity. There are two tactics for understanding these boundary terms. First of all, it's been known for many years now that you can rewrite 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity as a Chern-Simons gauge theory. In that formulation, there's a very simple decomposition of the fields into a gauge fixed piece and gauge transformations. And the reduction, the resulting boundary action is in principle very well understood, except for the particular boundary action that comes with quantum gravity, which is the one simple conformal field theory that's not very well understood. It's something called Liouville theory. That's life. But it is known in particular that the boundary term is the correct one for composing path integrals, for sewing integrals together at boundaries. So this is all very nice. The problem is that it doesn't generalize beyond three dimensions. This reduction to a Chern-Simons form is very particularly a characteristic of three dimensions. So instead, I'm going to dive in and do this the hard way, working with a standard metric formulation. This has the disadvantage that there isn't a simple description of the finite transformations, the diffeomorphisms, in terms of some simple gauge fixed quantities and some functions that describe the diffeomorphisms. The boundary theory might not be local because diffeomorphisms, the relevant gauge symmetries, move points around. But presumably, this method can be applied to more than three dimensions, and so it's worth spending some time on. So let me first briefly summarize some results for the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case. This is interesting because partly it touches on the ADS-CFT correspondence, and in fact, this is really the first place that a correspondence between bulk dynamics in anti-de Sitter space and gauge theory at the boundary was discovered and explored in any detail. It's interesting because the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case is the case that includes black holes in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so you might be able to learn something interesting about black holes. And it's interesting because it's simple, because the asymptotic behavior is well understood. So there are old results, mathematical results of Pfefferman and Graham, who show that in any asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, in this case in three dimensions, you can expand the metric in terms of a radial coordinate and set of an angular coordinate in time, which live in this two-dimensional Lorentzian metric, Gij, where Gij has some standard expansion. And in fact, the Einstein field equations in this case can be solved exactly, and all of the terms in that expansion can be written down in terms of a finite number of free functions. The kind of diffeomorphism that I'm interested in is one that doesn't respect the boundary conditions. So here, the boundary conditions are placed at a fixed value of this radial coordinate rho, which eventually we take to infinity in some limiting process to get full anti-de Sitter space. And so the diffeomorphisms that intuitively you would expect would not respect those boundary conditions are diffeomorphisms that move the boundary, that is, diffeomorphisms in the radial direction. And in fact, they don't preserve the boundary action. You can write such a diffeomorphism in terms of some function phi that describes the motion of the boundary, and some higher order terms of order e to the minus 2 rho, which are completely determined by just demanding that the general form of the metric remain in this Pfefferman-Gram form. The action for 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity is the ordinary Einstein-Hilbert action plus a boundary term. This is the Gibbons-Hawking boundary term, the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. There is also an additional term proportional to the volume of the boundary, which is added in order to subtract off infinities in the limit that the boundary goes to infinity to leave the total action finite. The original boundary was at some value of rho, say rho bar. The new boundary is at rho bar plus this variation. So all you have to do is take this new boundary, figure out its normal vector that determines the extrinsic curvature, figure out the induced metric that determines the volume, stick them into this action, and what you see is that the action is not invariant, that is, it's not independent of phi, and instead you get an induced action at the boundary, which depends on the scalar curvature at the boundary, and which can be recognized, if you're used to two-dimensional conformal field theory, as a limiting form of an action called the Liouville action. What do you get out of this? Well, first of all, this is a two-dimensional conformal field theory. Two-dimensional conformal field theories are characterized by a number, the central charge, which was known for 2 plus 1 dimensional gravity from work of Brown and Hanau, who didn't look at conformal field theory, but just looked at the symmetries of the asymptotic symmetries of the theory. This Liouville theory has the right central charge. And it turns out that this means that you can use standard conformal theory techniques to calculate the density of states and therefore the entropy. And if you are looking at a configuration that contains a black hole, you determine the entropy this way, you get the right answer. You get a quarter of the horizon area, in this case, the horizon circumference in Planck units. You can do more than this. You can take this conformal field theory and couple it with matter at infinity in the conformal field theory, calculate how the matter fields are excited by the conformal field theory, and use that to calculate Hawking radiation. And you get the right answer. You get the right temperature. You get the right gray body factors. Everything fits together very nicely. So at a minimum, this theory, which, remember, just came from saying that some of these diffeomorphisms at the boundary are now physical degrees of freedom, at a minimum, it gives a correct effective description of the microscopic states of the black hole in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Perhaps it does more. If we really understood this conformal field theory, we might be able to show or tell whether it really fully describes the states of the black hole as a full quantum theory of gravity. We don't know enough about Liouville theory to be able to answer that. That's unfortunate. OK, so that was a summary of work that's a few years old. For the past few months, I have been looking at the application to asymptotically flat rather than asymptotically anti-de Sitter space. So let me say a couple of words about the reason for this. It would be nice to say, well, after all, this is our universe, but our universe is probably not asymptotically flat either. Probably we need to look at asymptotically de Sitter, and that's hard. On the other hand, locally, our universe is pretty nearly asymptotically flat. We can get far and far away from matter and get to a region that's very nearly flat. And over the past year or so, a group, I guess led by Andy Strominger, but including people like Stephen Hawking and Perry and a bunch of others, have been arguing that if we understood the implications of the symmetries of null infinity in asymptotically flat space-time, this might give us important new degrees of freedom that could account for black hole hair in some sense, that could lead to degenerate vacua, and might have something to do with the information loss problem in black hole physics. I'm not going to solve the information loss problem here, even in 2+1 dimensions. Well, in 2+1 dimensions, there aren't any black holes in asymptotically flat general relativity, so I certainly am not going to solve it. But I want to introduce some techniques that perhaps can be generalized to something more like our real universe, and which tell us something more about these symmetries at infinity, the super translations and super rotations that Strominger and his friends have been so interested in. So here's a picture of asymptotically flat space-time, or that at least of the conformal compactification. One of the other advantages of working in 2+1 dimensions is that you can actually draw pictures that are reasonably accurate. So time slices are across here. This is null infinity, future null infinity, past null infinity. And I'm going to, as an analog to the Pfefferman-Graham coordinates that are used in the asymptotically anti-de Sitter case, I'm going to use what these days are called Bondi coordinates, though I'm told that this is not actually quite the coordinate system that Bondi first used. So here is the metric in Bondi coordinates. The basic things that go into this metric are that U is a retarded time, so the metric is foliated by these null cones of constant U, constant retarded time. And with this choice, in particular with this choice of the factor of minus 2, the radial direction R is an affine parameter along the geodesics that rule these outgoing cones. So you can think of the limit R going to infinity. You can think of that as taking a spatial limit, but you can instead think of it as following all of the geodesics along their affine parameter. And so you get to scry, to null infinity. There is a fairly trivial generalization of this, which is to stick in a more general function here. I don't think that that changes any of the conclusions that I'm going to reach, but I'm not sure. The one thing, I don't expect you to memorize this metric, but the one thing that I do want you to pay attention to is this factor of e to the 2 phi here. I should apologize. The traditional notation here uses a script phi as a conformal factor and a non-script phi as an angular coordinate. And I have not yet had a chance to go back and change my notation to one that makes more sense. I apologize on behalf of physicists everywhere. So anyway, the thing that you, that the one piece of this metric that's really going to matter is this script phi, the conformal factor here. This is just a measure of the failure of R to give the of 2 pi r to be the circumference of a circle. But in terms of the Penrose diagram, it's basically just the fact that you have the freedom to choose a conformal factor at infinity. OK, so the first step is to look at the behavior of that metric near infinity, that is, take that form, plug it into the Einstein field equation, see what you get out. The first thing you can do is look for symmetries that preserve that form. Those are the supertranslations and the superrotations. The supertranslations are basically just angular dependent shifts along the null geodesics. The superrotations are just reparameterizations of the angular coordinate. And these are the symmetries that preserve that Bondi form of the metric. You can then stick the metric into the field equations. I don't have to because Barnish and Trossard have done that. And you can solve the field equations and find the formula for these remaining components, GUU and GU phi, in terms of the conformal factor phi. And you get something. It's just some expression. This is up to terms of order 1 over r. There are two arbitrary functions that depend on angle alone, capital theta and capital xi. These have the interpretation of being the charges for supertranslations and superrotations. That is, that if you look at those transformations, you can just go through Noether's theorem and find the charges at infinity. And this is something typical of 2 plus 1 dimensions, that the source for a supertranslation is a rotation, and the source for a superrotation is a translation. OK, so we're interested in what happens to diffeomorphisms at a boundary. Yes?
I just had a question before you get to that. In 3 plus 1, what's the analog of superrotations? You don't hear about them in connection with the BMS group.
Right. So in 3 plus 1 dimensions, a superrotation is a mirror morphic transformation of the 2 sphere at infinity. So there aren't any holomorphic transformations except for the ordinary rotations. If you allow poles, then you can generalize the BMS group to get additional superrotations. There is a debate as to whether these are really legitimate symmetries. There's an argument that that they can lower the Bondi mass arbitrarily and therefore should not count. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, they're perfectly well behaved. It's basically because diffeomorphisms of the circle are nicer than diffeomorphisms of the sphere.
There's no genuine diffeomorphism of the sphere there.
Only if you allow poles.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call that a diffeomorphism.
Okay, yeah. Maybe if you say that your sphere at infinity has holes punched in it from, you could imagine saying that any physical null particle reaching infinity gives you a marked point, and then you might be able to do things that way. But yeah, I'm not going to especially argue in favor of those. Other questions? I should have said at the beginning, please feel free to interrupt with questions, which I probably won't know the answers to. This one I was lucky. Okay, so we're interested in what the diffeomorphisms do at infinity. And to do that, we need to figure out first what the right boundary term is. If we were looking at spatial infinity, then we would know the answer. It's the standard Gibbon Hawking's boundary term. Well, that's if we're looking at spatial infinity and if our boundary conditions are that the behavior of the metric at spatial infinity is fixed in a particular way. Here we're looking at null infinity, so things are a little different. The straightforward thing to do is to just compute the boundary term. That is, look at the variation of the ordinary Einstein action, expand in powers of 1 over r, we're taking a limit as r goes to infinity, and see what boundary terms come from integration by parts and have to get canceled off. And what you find is that, well, first of all, you find some boundary term just by doing the calculation. You can then use the asymptotic expansion, play a few games with this, and what you find is that there is a total variation here, which is good. That's just an additional piece, boundary piece you can add to the action. And then there's a piece of the form e to the phi delta g u u. The tildes here mean that miraculously the terms of order r and order 1 over r all cancel out, and it's only the terms of order 1 that come into the variation. So what this tells you is that in order to have a well-defined variational principle at all, you have to either fix phi or fix GUU, which is that function of phi and its derivatives and the super rotation generator, or some combination. Yes?
When you talk about the boundary, like even from Minkowski spacetime, we know that it doesn't have a boundary, but when you compactify, it does.
Yeah.
So here, are you doing the action for the compactified version?
Yes.
But
well, what's the right way to say this? What I am doing is I'm looking at the action for the non-compactified version and taking the limit as r goes to infinity. You can then translate that into a statement about the compactified version by simply changing variables from r to 1 over r and doing a conformal transformation. But so I'm talking about scribe plus, in this case, in the usual way that it's defined, but without explicitly introducing the compactification. Other questions?
Do you necessarily have to fix those kinds of boundary conditions? How do you know there's not some kind of boundary condition, boundary term you could write down that gives you that?
So in this case, you can actually tell it by inspection because delta GUU has a term that involves GUU has this arbitrary function theta that is completely arbitrary. And so there's no way of canceling off. So the variations of theta are independent of the variations of phi tilde because theta is just an arbitrary function. So there is no term that will cancel. there. I mean, more generally, what you do, you think of delta as being an exterior derivative on the space of fields. And so what you have here is a one form on the space of fields. And what you are asking is whether it's exact, whether it is a variation, a delta of some function on the space of fields. So you can actually analyze the cohomology of the space of fields, which I haven't done. But as a first step, you can just look at whether delta of this is zero, because d squared is zero. So if you have a one form omega that is d of something else, then d of that one form is zero. So you just look at delta of this and you get something which is delta phi wedge delta GUU, and that's not zero because delta phi and delta GUU are independent.
Yeah, I think there might be more subtle than that, but keep on going.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really much more subtle than that. I mean, it's a little bit more in the sense that you could have, well, no, actually it's not. You could have a more complicated cohomology in the space of fields, in which case you could have forms that were closed but not exact. But that would tell you that even if delta of this was zero, that wouldn't guarantee that it was delta of something. It's actually enough to just show that delta of this term is not identically zero, to tell you that there is no general boundary term that can cancel it off. This is typical, though. This is going to be true in any field theory, that if you look at the variation, say if you just think about the point particle, for instance, the variation of the action is going to have a boundary piece, which is p delta q. And what that tells you, first of all, delta of that is delta p wedge delta q. That's the symplectic form on the space, on the phase space of the point particle. And that tells you that you have to have as your boundary conditions fixing some function of p and q, either p, the simplest choice is either p or q or a linear combination. But you have to fix some combination so that delta p wedge delta q restricted to that those boundary terms is zero.
I don't agree, but I want to see what else you have to say.
Okay. Okay. So you have a choice of what you want to fix at the boundary given this variation. I will choose to fix the conformal factor phi. That tells you what the boundary term is. You get a slightly different boundary term if you fix GUU, but not very different. So that's your boundary term. It doesn't look very geometrical. It's not something nice like the Gibbons-Hawking integral of the extrinsic curvature. As it turns out, though, it can be recast in a geometrical form. You look at the surfaces R equals constant, find their unit normal, and find the induced metric on the surface R equals constant. You choose a null vector that is a null normal of these outgoing null cones, so something that's proportional to du, and normalize it so that its inner product with the unit normal is equal to 1. And then the boundary term is basically just the expansion of this null vector. There is a proposal by Padmanabhan for a general boundary term for null boundaries, which is at least closely related to this, but I haven't yet looked at it carefully enough to say that it's exactly the same. The trick is finding a normalization.
Isn't this affine dependent?
Not once I've chosen this normalization.
Where's the Thompson factor when I change the normalization of L?
If you change the normalization of N is fixed because N is a unit vector. N is a normal to R equals constant, which I guess is a time-like surface. So if you change the normalization of L, then that's going to change N dot L. So this definitely uses the fact that you have a unit normal vector which you're using to normalize L.
You're fixing the norm of the null vector, which I wouldn't like you to, but maybe there's something.
Well, I'm not fixing the norm of the null vector. I'm fixing its dot product into, I'm saying there's a preferred constant R, so dr, so there's a preferred dr is time-like. No.
I thought R was
null. No. No, it's not. It's definitely not. That's what allows you to fix this. Otherwise, the question of how you fix the normalization is peculiar. And so, I mean, all I'm saying about this, this is true, and it is geometric in the sense that I have written everything in terms of quantities that can be defined entirely from the geometry and that no longer have to depend on the coordinate system, but I don't really understand what it means. Not even the first, but one of many things that I don't understand about this. Okay, so this is basically what I had just said before. If you look at a radial decomposition of the theory, you can find on a surface of constant R, you can find the induced metric and the conjugate momentum and look at the symplectic structure, symplectic potential pi delta q, and it's GUU delta e to the phi, which again is telling you that GUU and e to the phi are conjugate variables. Okay, so we have a boundary term now. We have a general form of the metric. What I have been arguing is that one of the main reasons this is interesting is that it gives dynamics to those diffeomorphisms that don't preserve the boundary term. So to see that, we need to see how those diffeomorphisms appear in this expression for the metric. Well, that's, in this case, fairly straightforward because the spacetime is asymptotically flat, which allows us to do expansions in 1 over r near infinity. So we can start with just a standard flat Minkowski metric, look at arbitrary diffeomorphisms diffeomorphisms that don't change the R dependence near infinity. So just say that retarded time u goes to some function plus something over R, angular coordinate some functions plus something over R. R gets shifted in the same kind of way. Then just stick these transformations into the metric and demand that it remains in this Bondi form, and you get some relationships among these parameters that label the diffeomorphisms. I'm not going to go through the details here. I mean, you just sit down and spend 2 hours doing the calculation and then 2 hours redoing it and finding your mistakes and then 2 hours doing it a third time, the usual. But you end up with something which is almost certainly correct, although I haven't written up, I haven't written the paper yet, so there'll be at least one more check of this. But what you find is that if you stick in these diffeomorphisms, the metric does in fact take that form that Barnish and Trossert found, but now with a particular interpretation that the conformal factor is a function, e to the phi, you can write as the phi derivative of the diffeomorphism of phi divided by the u derivative of the diffeomorphism of u. So it has some expression in terms of the diffeomorphisms. The theta, which was the charge for the super translations, also has a nice form in terms of those diffeomorphisms. And in particular, when you write this out, you find that one of the terms is something called a Schwarzian derivative. And if you are familiar with two-dimensional conformal field theory, you jump up and down because that's where Schwarzian derivatives make their most notorious appearances. They are the transformation of a stress energy tensor of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. So you say, aha, this has something to do with two-dimensional conformal field theory. Now, you can go back and write that boundary action in terms of these diffeomorphism parameters. I've kept phi here, but you should read phi as a function of the functions phi naught and u naught that give the diffeomorphisms of the retarded time and the angle. And you find something. That's what it looks like. And you see that, in fact, this is not invariant under the diffeomorphisms. If it were, then this would be zero, or it would be at least the same as it is for the flat metric. So as claimed, the boundary action picks up, so gives you some new dynamics of those diffeomorphisms that don't preserve your boundary conditions. So what can we say about this action? Well, first of all, it's kind of peculiar. It doesn't have any u derivatives. And I don't know why. Well, I mean, I can calculate why, but I don't understand physically why. It doesn't contain this function c, which was the charge for super rotations. Now, I believe that this is, I think, not too surprising. It's for essentially the same reason that in the ordinary ADM formulation of general relativity, the boundary term in the action involves the mass but not the angular momentum. The relevant transformations are higher order in 1 over r. It's a little sad, though, because it would be nice to have that, have some action that involved that. Yes? So
I got slightly lost. Is this still diffeomorphisms of flat space?
Yes.
Right? Okay.
It's diffeomorphisms of flat 2 plus 1 dimensional space.
So is this the general thing, or would something different happen if had a curve that, I mean, you don't want to limit yourself just to flat space.
In 2 plus 1 dimensions, asymptotically flat implies flat. But the calculations that lead to this only involve leading terms in powers of 1 over r near scribe plus. So in principle, you ought to be able to do this same calculation in asymptotically flat space in higher dimensions.
Well, when you say flat, does it allow conical singularity at infinity or,
here, yes.
or not?
Yeah.
It does
yeah. allow it. Yeah. Conical singularity, so as it turns out, are very hard to see from scry. They're easy to see from spatial infinity. From scry, they show up only in holonomies, and they come in as integrals of that parameter theta around a circle, for instance.
I see. So we didn't assume that the space-time had to be globally flat in this
no.
calculation.
We assumed that it was asymptotically flat and that it obeyed the vacuum field equations. Well, even there, really all that was involved is that it asymptotically obeyed the vacuum field equations. So, yeah, in principle, I think you could have even a non-vacuum configuration in the interior, and some curvature there as long as it was asymptotically flat.
Just to check one, when you say no u derivative, that's like saying it has no quote-unquote kinetic term in some sense.
Right. And this is one of the things I don't understand about this. But it's something that has shown up elsewhere when people have worked on the Chern-Simons formulation of this same kind of question. So, open question. Okay, so the next thing you can do is say, well, what if you take that action and you just find the equations of motion for the various diffeomorphism parameters? Well, if you vary phi, what you find is an equation that is called Hill's equation, or as physicists would call it, the Schrodinger equation. Well, except that everything's real. But mathematicians call it Hill's equation. This function t that appears as the source of the Schrodinger equation is essentially the stress energy tensor for a Liouville theory, which again is an indication of some connection to two-dimensional conformal field theory. And in fact, there's even a much closer connection, which is that Hill's equation is very closely related to the coadjoint quantization of the Virasoro group. So first of all, the Virasoro group is the central extension of the group of diffeomorphisms of a circle. So you have a circle, you can just take phi, going to some arbitrary function of phi that has the correct periodicity. That you write down the generators, that group of diffeomorphisms gives you is something called the Witt algebra, the algebra of the generators. And that algebra has a essentially unique central extension that's determined by a single number C called the central charge, which is a thing that came up earlier in Liouville theory. If you write Hill's equation in this form, then you get back a very close connection to the Virasoro group. This is a second order equation, so it has two independent solutions. If you take any quadratic combination of those two solutions and define that to be epsilon, then this particular combination, minus C over 12 epsilon triple prime minus 2 epsilon prime t minus epsilon t prime, is identically zero by virtue of the Hill's equation. If, on the other hand, you interpret T as being a stress energy tensor in a conformal field theory, then this right-hand side is just the transformation of a stress energy tensor under an infinitesimal diffeomorphism parameterized by epsilon. I'm saying stress energy tensor. What I mean here is the phi phi component of the stress energy tensor. And so that means that the solutions of Hill's equation label the orbits of the Virasoro group, the orbits of diffeomorphisms that leave a stress energy tensor fixed, which again is a connection to a conformal, two-dimensional conformal field theory. In fact, you can go a step further than this. I would like to go two steps further, but I only know the first one so far. There's some work by Alexeyev and Shadashvili from the, late 1980s, who said, let's look at the space of co-adjoint orbits of the Virasoro group. This is a phase space. It has a symplectic structure. Let's quantize it. They wrote down an action for that quantization. That action is almost exactly the same as the boundary action that I have, except that it has the extra derivative. It has F here is the equivalent of phi naught, and it has the time derivatives as well as the spatial derivatives. Now, in fact, this is virtually identical to the action that I wrote down, this boundary action, if you identify F prime with the spatial derivative, but F dot with the time derivative of a different function, U naught. There must be some way of combining these, of just taking some product or something of that sort and getting exactly this Virasoro co-adjoint orbit quantization. But I don't know what it is yet. Finally, this is also very closely related to a different quantization of Liouville theory that was first introduced by Polyakov. Let me, for the moment, just out of thin air, introduce a two-dimensional metric, which depends on phi and on beta, which are together completely label these diffeomorphisms. You can work out the curvature of this two-dimensional metric, and you can write down something called the Polyakov action for this curvature. And it turns out that that Polyakov action in this choice of coordinates is exactly the same as the boundary action for this asymptotically flat 2 plus 1 dimensional space-time. The Polyakov action is also exactly the same as the action for Liouville theory in a different parameterization. That is, if you take this metric and you change the two-dimensional coordinates, you get an equivalent action, but that looks like a Liouville action. Now, as I said, I pulled this out of nowhere. But if you rewrite it in terms of these diffeomorphisms, there's a piece proportional to d phi squared, which is, in fact, the induced metric at the boundary. And then there is a time-like piece in which the time coordinate is related to u plus phi. So this, so that's somehow a time that's wrapping around scry. This looks like, one way to get this is to go back to the asymptotically anti-de Sitter space, where you naturally have left and right moving spirals around the boundary. And this looks like it's somehow grabbing onto one of those. But again, I don't know what's going on here. So the conclusion is that there's something interesting here, that the asymptotic behavior of diffeomorphisms in asymptotically flat space is dynamical. It has an action which is very clearly related to two-dimensional conformal field theory in a bunch of different ways, but I don't yet know how to put these all together to say here is the correct and correctly interpreted two-dimensional theory that describes this behavior. So the hope, as I said, is to do this in 3+1 dimensions, where things are a little bit more complicated, but probably not too terribly much more complicated. And in that case, you might be able to actually get a dynamical description of these super translations and super rotations that some people are so excited about these days. Thank you.
Steve, any questions? Rafael?
You said, what is this U naught? Can you say again what it was? It showed up on a
page. Oh, sure. Yeah.
It seemed arbitrary, or I didn't understand.
It is almost arbitrary. It is that I'm saying, do a diffeomorphism in which the coordinate u, the retarded time, is changed to a function u naught of u and phi. So it's just the diffeomorphism of the retarded time.
But it is a parameter of your diffeomorphism. Yeah. Group.
Yeah, so u naught is, u naught is just a change of u. Phi naught is just a change of phi. Beta, which is the other thing that appeared, is just a derivative of phi naught. And curly phi, the conformal factor, is just a ratio of the derivatives of those diffeomorphisms. So it's really U naught and phi naught that completely characterize the diffeomorphism.
And can you repeat? You listed three actions and you said the relations, but I didn't take it all in. So there's the Polyakov action, there's the Liouville action, and there's your boundary action.
Okay, so here's the boundary action. It is, okay, so the Polyakov action is the same as the action of the Polyakov action in light cone gauge is the same as the action for co-adjoint orbit quantization of the Virasoro group. The Polyakov action in conformal gauge is the action of Liouville theory. Both of these, so they're the same action written in different, they're both actions for two-dimensional gravity written in different gauges, but they're equivalent. Both of them are very closely connected to the boundary action that I found, but in both cases there's a little gap to their two different little gaps that keep me from yet being able to say they're exactly the same.
So you mean the poly, whatever we call this other action, it's all the same?
Polyakov, Liouville, Shadashvili, Alexeyev, Shadashvili are all actions for, they're all, so the original Polyakov action is a non-local two-dimensional gravity action of this form. In one gauge, that gives Liouville theory. In a different gauge, it gives the Alexeyev-Shadashvili action. Both of those are nearly the two-dimensional diffeomorphism boundary action.
So is your hope that if you find a third gauge in which it would actually be the
I think that
boundary action.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there is actually a third gauge in which the action is the sum of the Liouville action and the Alexeyev-Shadashvili action. You could do a whole lot here. So there's a very tight connection, but it's not quite tied up yet.
So in going to 3 plus 1 dimensions, are you proposing that we should take these super rotations seriously there, that this diff S2 generalization of the SL2C part of the DNS group?
I am not sure.
Okay.
I would be happier if what happened is that you got a nice action for the super translations and didn't have to worry about the super rotations, because the super translations are really there and the super rotations are debated. I mean, one hope is that because here we started with 3 dimensions, we got a 2-dimensional action, but where everything depends only on one variable. My hope would be that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, we would ultimately end up with an action that maybe only depended on 2 variables and might then itself be a 2-dimensional conformal field theory.
So, the analog of that conformal factor that you have would be the like what you'd have to differentiate to get the news, or it's a part of the two-sphere part.
It is. Let me think how this works. So usually, people choose coordinates in which that conformal factor is just set to 0. One way of understanding it is that in the conformal compactification, the conformal factor that gives you the compactification is unique only up to a conformal transformation that is finite at infinity. And that's really what that factor is.
So it's just not there.
Well, you can choose coordinates in which it's not there, but I suppose what I would argue is that choosing coordinates in which it's not there is a mistake, because you should allow diffeomorphisms that change coordinates in such a way that it reappears.
I was reading that there was a result that in 3 plus 1 dimensions, super translation charges would vanish identically, either at scry or black hole horizons, and that super rotation charges would stay, would survive. You heard anything about these claims?
I have heard the claims. I don't yet know enough about this to be able to say much beyond the fact that the people making the claims are pretty good and probably know what they're doing. But there might be some subtleties that have been missed.
Rafael, I don't want to push you beyond what you're comfortable,
go ahead, push.
Or I do want to push you beyond.
That's fine. That's why I'm here.
What does this all mean for quantum gravity? Suppose these are real degrees. Does it mean, and it all goes over somehow to 3 plus 1, or we're living in 2 plus 1? Does it mean there are new kinds of non-local degrees of freedom in the theory that we weren't aware of before?
Okay, well, if you really push me on this, I'll tell you my wild guess, just so long as you understand that this really is a wild guess. Although it's similar to something that Laurent Friedel has been advocating, so at least two people have vaguely the same wild guess. One of the standard problems, one of the most basic standard problems in quantum gravity is that there are no local degrees of freedom, ever, at all. One way to get a non-local degrees of freedom is to simply choose some surface, fix some data on that surface, and then that data allows you to then extract degrees of freedom from the geometry. So for example, you can fix a two-sphere and say that you are restricting yourself to the situation in which this two-sphere is observably round and has a certain area. And if you then look at the action for general relativity with that put in as a boundary condition, you get new induced degrees of freedom because that's a boundary condition that is not invariant under all diffeomorphisms. This gives you too many degrees of freedom for quantum gravity because there are too many different surfaces that you could choose, but they shouldn't all be independent. There should be some way of saying if you have two surfaces which agree most places but differ a little bit, then here's how the degrees of freedom change in this little bump where they differ. So my wild hope is that this would give you the set of observables for quantum gravity. The more common hope is that you get something like the ADS-CFT correspondence in asymptotically flat space-time, where somehow understanding some induced field theory at infinity is already enough to completely give you the quantum theory in the interior. That's not quite as unreasonable as it sounds, because, for example, there are old results which Gary Horowitz and I think a student just have a new paper that's reviving these. There are old results that say that if you take a set of good cuts at scry, that those are enough to determine the entire metric up to a conformal factor. And sort of like causal sets. So if there is some way of getting a conformal factor as well, then perhaps the dynamics at scry is enough to give you the interior dynamics. And then if you can quantize what happens at scry, that would give you a quantum theory of gravity.
Just a follow-up. Suppose you do this just in linearized theory. Then there's more sets of locality that remain.
Yeah. So I don't know.
Say to what extent.
Yeah. I mean, there's some old work by Ashtekar from the 70s who looked at that, but I haven't yet reread it carefully enough to remember exactly what you can and can't do with it.
He did this paper, of course, with Lorentzian and magic ripples, which is not the Lorentzian case, but the Feynman case. And this was actually linearized gravity. And we do find very similar results in the sense that you directly identify the boundary field theory, which now is a kind of linearized, looks like a linearized Liouville field theory, where actually also one kinetic part is vanishing. It's not appearing, which actually is a angular part.
Yeah.
It's an obvious angular part. And
the time is there, but
and the Liouville field, it has directly this interpretation, also Steve mentioned, which is it's just a distance from some center through the boundary. So it directly gives you the reconstruction of the bulk in some sense, because you can directly identify So you live here with the length of these geodetics, and it's kind of straightforward to do this calculation of magic hyperbolas. And currently we are doing, I mean, or not doing, we are doing that in the continuum, also again at the inference level for, and the point is that we look at final boundaries and all kinds of shapes for the thing. So to see whether we get in all cases something which resembles some kind of local field theory. But you can argue that you always get a local field theory in the boundary in 3D. And we can do the computation actually for the linear scale.
Exactly.
Directly. Yeah.
I'll talk about it. I don't know, this is maybe too incomprehensible, what I was about to say to most people, so maybe I'll save it.
Okay, thank you. All right, good time. Let's thank Steve again.